That quality is what he wants to exhibit by his personality. Consequently, if the personality tries to feel strong affection, and makes a specialty of that, the ego will promptly throw more of himself into the personality, page 206, because he finds in it exactly what he desires. In the savage, the self expresses itself in all kinds of emotions and passions of which the ego could not possibly approve. But, in the developed man, there are no emotions but such as he chooses to have. Instead of being swayed by emotions, and carried off his feet, he simply selects them. He would say, for example, love is a good thing, I will allow myself to feel love. Devotion is a good thing, I will allow myself to feel devotion. Sympathy is beautiful, I will allow myself to feel sympathy. This he does with his eyes open, intentionally. The emotions are thus under the dominion of the mind, and that mind is an expression of the causal body, so that the man is coming very near to the condition of complete unity of the higher and lower self. Page 137. The connection between the ego and the mental body is of the greatest importance, and every effort should be made to keep it active and alive. For the ego is the force behind, which makes use of the qualities and powers of the personality. In order that we may think of anything, we must remember it. In order that we may remember it, we must have paid attention to it, and the paying attention is the descent of the ego into his vehicles in order to look through them. Many a man with a fine mental body and a good brain makes little use of them, because he pays little attention to life, that is to say, because the ego is putting but little of himself down into these lower planes, and so the vehicles are left to run riot at their own will. The remedy for this has already been stated. It is to give the ego the conditions he requires, when there will be no reason to complain of his response. It appears that the actual experiences of the personality cannot be transmitted to the ego, but the essence of them may be passed to him. The ego cares little for details, but does want the essence of experiences. This being so, it is evident, page 207, that the ordinary man has in his life very little that appeals to the ego. The system of yielding up results of the lower work, but not the detailed experiences, proceeds all the time until adeptship is attained. The student will do well to follow the advice given in Light on the Path: watch for the ego, and let him fight through you, but at the same time remember, always, that you are the ego. Therefore identify yourself with him, and make the lower give way to the higher. Even if you fall many times, there is no reason to be disheartened, for even failure is to a certain extent success, since by failure we learn, and so are wiser to meet the next problem. It is not expected that we should invariably succeed, but only that we shall always do our best. Moreover, we must recollect that the ego has associated himself with the personality because he has a hunger, or thirst, trishna, for vivid experience. As he develops, the hunger abates little by little, and sometimes, when he is advanced, and has become more sensitive to the delights and activities of his own plane, he goes to the other extreme of neglecting his personality, caught as it is in the grip of karma, sunk in conditions which are now full of sorrow or of boredom to the ego, because he feels that he has outgrown them. This diminution of the thirst has taken place as he developed his personality. When he gained full consciousness on the astral plane, the physical began to appear dull by comparison. Reaching the lower mental world, he found the astral dark and dismal, and all four of the lower levels lost their attraction when he began to enjoy the still more vivid and luminous life of the causal body. As has already been pointed out, it is necessary ever to bear in mind that consciousness is one. It is, therefore, quite mistaken to conceive of the ego, or higher self, as something above, something essentially foreign to ourselves, and consequently hard to reach. Page 208. Often we speak of the tremendous effort required to reach the higher self, at other times of the inspiration, etc., which comes, page 138, from the higher self to us down below. In all these cases, we make the fundamental mistake of identifying ourselves with that which we are not, instead of that which we fundamentally are. The first condition of spiritual achievement is the certainty, beyond any doubt, that we are the ego of higher self, The second condition is that we have full confidence in our own powers as the ego, and the courage to use them freely. Instead, therefore, of looking upon the consciousness of the personality as usual and normal, we should accustom ourselves to look upon the consciousness of the personality as abnormal and unnatural, and the life of the ego as our own true life, from which by continuous effort we keep ourselves estranged. This attitude to the various bodies should be adopted in practical life. Thus, the physical body should not be permitted to work of its own accord, but should be deliberately and consciously trained to obey the behests of the ego. In this way will be brought about what the Hermetic philosophers called the regeneration of the body. This is a real change which, when accomplished, forever breaks the dominion of the physical body over the consciousness, making it instead an instrument for the use of the ego. A similar change should be brought about with regard to the astral body. Instead of permitting the world of emotion to influence it and determine its activity, the ego should himself decide and determine what emotions he will entertain, what feelings he permits himself to radiate from his astral body. Thus the consciousness of the ego becomes disentangled from the astral body, and that body becomes subservient to the wishes of the ego. Perhaps most essential of all is control of the mental body, because thought is the manifestation of the supreme creative energy. We should never allow thought images to be incited from without, page 209. Instead, when thought images are made, they should be created by the deliberate, self-conscious action of the ego himself. Great danger lies in the undisciplined imagination. Were it not for the imagination, external objects of desire would have no power over us. The ego should therefore acquire full control over the imagination, and permit it to exercise its function only in such directions as he determines. Uncontrolled imagination acts also as a powerful factor in undermining and weakening the will. Only too often, after some resolution has been made, the imagination is allowed to play with the unpleasant aspects of what it has been decided to do, until eventually it is made to appear so unpleasant that the idea of doing it is given up altogether. Shakespeare uttered deep psychological truth when he made Hamlet say, "The native hue of resolution is sick allied or with the pale cast of thought." The remedy for this unfortunate habit is obvious. The will and attention should be irrevocably concentrated, not on the difficulties or unpleasantnesses which we imagine confront us, but on the task which is to be done. "Nervous with constant affirmatives," said Emerson. Pursuing the analysis a little further, we should abandon the widespread idea that the will does things, page 139, that we carry through something by an effort of the will. To do and carry out is not the function of the will, but of the quite different aspect of the ego, the creative activity. The will is the ruler, the king who says this shall be done, but who does not go and do things himself. Psychologically speaking, the will is the power to hold the consciousness focused on one thing and exclude everything else. In itself, it is perfectly serene, quiet, and unmoving, being, as said, just the power to hold one thing and exclude all else. It is scarcely possible to fix the limits of the power of the human will when properly directed. It is so, page 210, much more far-reaching than the ordinary man ever supposes, that the results gained by its means appear to him astounding and supernatural. A study of its powers brings one gradually to realize what was meant by the statement that if faith were only sufficient, it could remove mountains and cast them into the sea, and even that oriental description seems scarcely exaggerated when one examines authenticated instances of what has been achieved by this marvelous power. Perhaps the most important factor in a successful use of the will is perfect confidence, which of course, may be gained in various ways, according to the type of person concerned. As soon as man realizes that there is the inner and spiritual world of the ego, which is of enormously more importance in every way than that which is external, he may well adopt the attitude of an actor, who plays his part in the world, only because of the true life inside. An actor takes various parts at different times, just as we come back in other incarnations and wear other kinds of bodies. But all the time the actor has his real life as a man and as an artist as well, and, because he has that life of his own, he wants to play his part well, in the temporary life of the stage. Similarly, We should wish to do well in our temporary life here, because of the great reality behind, of which it is a very small fragment. If this is clearly realized, we shall see what is the relative importance of this outer life, that its only value to us is that we shall play our part well, whatever that part may be, what kind of part it is, and what happens to us in this mimic existence. These things matter little. It may be an actor's business to go through all sorts of pretended sorrows and difficulties, but these do not trouble him in the least. He may, for example, have to be killed every night in a duel. What does the feigned death matter to him? The only thing that concerns him is that he should acquit himself well. Hence, it should not be difficult to realize that the, page 211, world about us is a mimic world, and that it really does not matter what experiences may come to us. All things that happen to people from the outside are a result of their karma. The causes were set up going long ago in other lives, and cannot now be altered. Therefore it is useless to worry about the things that happen. They should be borne philosophically. The way in which they are born molds the character for the future, and that is the only important thing. One should use karma to develop courage, endurance and various other good qualities, and then dismiss it from the mind. Thus the groping, striving, struggling divine self becomes, as evolution proceeds, the true ruler, the inner ruler immortal. A man who grasps that he is himself that immortal ruler, seated within his self-created vehicles of expression, gains a sense of dignity and power which grows ever stronger and more compelling on the lower nature. The knowledge of the truth makes us free. Page 140. The inner ruler may still be hampered by the very forms he has shaped for self-expression. But, knowing himself as the ruler, he can work steadfastly to bring his realm into complete subjection. He knows that he has come into the world for a certain purpose, to make himself fit to be a co-worker with the supreme will, and he can do and suffer all which is necessary to that end. He knows himself divine, and that his self-realization is only a matter of time. Inwardly, the divinity is felt, though outwardly it is not yet expressed. His task is to become in manifestation what he is in essence. He is king de jure, not yet de facto. As a prince, born to a crown, patiently submits to the discipline which is fitting him to wear it, so the sovereign will in us is evolving to the age when royal powers will pass into its grasp, and may therefore patiently submit to the necessary discipline of life. A correct view of the relationship between the ego and his successive personalities should suffice to clear up, page 212, the misunderstandings which have arisen regarding the teachings of the Lord Buddha. The Buddha preached constantly against the idea which was evidently prevalent in his time, of the continuation of the personality. But while he taught that nothing of all that, with which men generally identify themselves, lasts forever, he made most unequivocal statements about the successive lives of men. He gave examples of preceding lives, and compared successive incarnations to days that one may have spent in this village or in that. Nevertheless, the Southern Church of Buddhism now teaches that only karma persists, not an ego, as though man in one life made a certain amount of karma, and then died, and nothing was left of him, but another person was born, and had to bear the karma which that person did not make. With curious illogicality, however, in spite of the formal teaching to the contrary, a practical belief in the continued existence of the individual persists, because, for example, the Buddhist monks speak of attaining nirvana, and recognize that this will take many lives. The real significance of this teaching of the Buddha lies in the great emphasis he laid on the external temporary part of man which does not endure, and the implication that the parts of man which are not temporary or external do survive as the enduring ego, the real man. His teaching, however, went still deeper than this. There is a passage in the Srivaikya Sutta which warns the aspirant that when he repeats the great formula I am that, he must take care what he means by I. It explains that the separate individual should be understood as threefold, and that it is the union of Brahman only of the highest of these three that is proclaimed by Thou art that, and such sayings. We have already abundantly seen that the personality is not I, and even the you in me is not I, the I is something indistinguishable, page 213, from the universal self, in which the many and the one are one. The Lord Buddha's teaching denies the permanency of you, that men call I. Much wisdom is often wrapped up in etymology. Thus the very word person is compounded of the two, page 141, Latin words per and sona, and therefore signifies, that through which the sound comes, that is, the mask worn by the Roman actor to indicate the part which he happened at the moment to be playing. Thus we very appropriately speak of the group of temporary lower vehicles, which an ego assumes when he descends into incarnation, as his personality. Almost equally instructive are the words individual and individuality, which are highly appropriate when applied to the ego. For individual means that which is not divisible without loss of identity, subsisting as one, and individuality is defined as separate and distinct existence. Going a stage further still, the word exist derives from ex, out, and sist here, to make to stand. Thus the ego or individuality is made to stand out, from the monad, and manifests itself through the mask of the personality. Diagram 29 is an attempt to illustrate one aspect of the relationship between the ego and his successive personalities. We see in the diagram, first, the monad deriving his life from the unmanifest, and projecting below himself his ego, with his threefold characteristics or aspects. The ego in turn projects, page 214, from himself into the lower planes a series of successive personalities. These are shown in the drawing as gradually widening out, as they develop, until eventually the last personality is equilateral, being fully and symmetrically developed, thereby expressing, as fully as its inherent limitations permit, the nature and powers of the ego. As people develop, the personal consciousness may be unified with the life of the ego as far as that is possible, and then there is only one consciousness. Even in the personal consciousness there will be the consciousness of the ego, who will know all that is going on. But, as already said, with many people, at the present day, there is often considerable opposition between the personality and the ego. A man who has succeeded in raising his consciousness to the level of the causal body, and thereby unifying the consciousness of the lower and the higher selves, of the personality with the individuality or ego has, of course, the consciousness of the ego at his disposal during the whole of his physical life. This will not be at all affected by the death of the physical body, nor even by the second and third deaths in which he leaves behind him the astral and mental bodies respectively. His consciousness, in fact, resides in the ego all the time, and plays through whatever vehicle he may happen at any given moment to be using. For him the whole series of his incarnations is only one long life. What we call an incarnation is to him a day in that life. All through his human evolution, his consciousness is fully active. Incidentally, we may note that he is generating karma just as much at one period as at another, and while his condition at any given moment is the result of the causes he has set in motion in the past, yet there is no instant at which he is not modifying his conditions by the exercise of thought and will. Whilst this consideration applies to all men, yet it is clear that one who possesses the ego consciousness is in a position to modify his karma more deliberately, and with, page 215, more calculated effect, than one who has not achieved continuous, page 142, ego consciousness. H.P. Blavatsky speaks of the higher self as the great master, though she is here using the term master in an unusual sense, different from that in which it is mostly employed today. It is, she says, the equivalent of Avalokiteshvara, and the same as Adi Buddha with the Buddhist occultists, Ma, with the Brahmanas, and Christos with the ancient Gnostics. Page 143, Chapter 27, The Ego in the Personality, page 216. There are a number of ways in which the activity of the ego may be more specifically observed as operating through the consciousness of the personality. In the first place, as has been pointed out more than once, anything evil or selfish cannot, by the very mechanism of the higher planes, affect the ego, and we may therefore say that he has nothing to do with it. Unselfish thoughts and feelings alone can affect the ego. All the lower thoughts and feelings affect the permanent atoms, not the ego, and as we have seen, corresponding to them we find gaps in the causal body, not bad colors. The ego is concerned only with purely unselfish feelings and thoughts. Most people are conscious of times when they are filled with splendid inspiration and exaltation, with glowing devotion and joy. These moments, of course, are precisely those when the ego succeeds in impressing himself upon the lower consciousness, but that which is then felt is, in reality, there all the time, though the personality is not always conscious of it. The aspirant should endeavor to realize, both by reason and by faith, that it is always there, and it will then appear as though he actually felt it, even at times when the link is imperfect, and when he does not feel it in the personal consciousness. Moreover, it is obvious that while the mind is responding to the appeals of he physical, astral and lower mental planes, it is not likely to hear the message that the ego is trying to transmit to the personality from his own higher planes. An emotional impulse belonging to the astral plane is sometimes mistaken for a real spiritual aspiration, page 217, because what happens in the buddhic vehicle, if brought down to the personality, is reflected in the astral body. A standard example of this phenomenon is to be found in religious revivalist meetings. Such great emotional upheavals, whilst sometimes beneficial, were in many instances harmful, tending to throw people off their mental balance. Two simple but excellent rules may be given for differentiating between a true intuition and a mere impulse. First, if the matter be laid aside for a while, and slept on, an impulse will probably die away, a genuine intuition will remain as strong as ever. Second, true intuition is always connected with something unselfish. If there is any touch of selfishness, it may be taken as certain that it is only as astral impulse, and not a true buddhic intuition. The influence of the ego is often felt on occasions when one seems to know by inner conviction that a thing is true without being able to reason it out. The ego knows, and has good reason for his knowledge, but sometimes he cannot impress his reasons on the physical brain, though the bare fact that he knows manages to come through. Hence, when a new truth is presented to us, we know at once whether we can accept it or not. That is not superstition, but an intense inner conviction. Superficially, it may appear to be abandoning reason in favor of intuition, but then it must be remembered that buddhi, which we translate intuition, is, page 144, as known in India as pure reason. It is the reason of the ego, which is a type higher than that which we have on the lower planes. More specifically, we may say that manas gives inspiration, buddhi gives intuition as to right and wrong. Ma is the directing conscience, commanding that the man should follow that which he knows to be best, often when a mind is trying to invent some excuse to do otherwise. Again, the manifestation of genius are but a momentary grasping of the brain by the large, page 218, consciousness of the ego, forcing it into an insight, a strength of grip, and a width of outlook, that causes its noble reach. This large consciousness is the real self, the real man. Many things that we see around us, or that happen to us, are hints of this larger consciousness, whisperings, scarcely articulate as yet, but with all the promise of the future, that come from the land of our birth, from the world to which we truly belong. They are the voice of the living spirit, unborn, undying, ancient, perpetual, constant. They are the voice of the inner God, speaking in the body of man. Life teaches us into ways, by tuition that the world gives us, and by intuition the working of the inner self. As men develop, their intuition increases, and they do not depend so much as before on the instruction that the world gives. That is another way of saying that the man who uses his inner powers can learn much more from a little experience than other men can from a great deal. Because of the activity of his innate intelligence, the developed man is able to see the great significance of even small things, but the undeveloped mind is full of curiosity. It is eager for novelty, because, not being good at thinking, it soon exhausts the obvious significance of commonplace things. This mind is the one that craves miracles in connection with its religious experience, as it is blind to the countless miracles that surround it all the time. What we call the dictates of conscience come from above, and represent usually the knowledge of the ego on the subject. But here a word of caution is necessary. The ego himself is as yet but partially developed. His knowledge on any given subject may be quite small, or even inaccurate, and he can reason only from the information before him. Because of this, a man's conscience often misleads him, for an ego who is young, and knows but little, may yet be able to impress his will upon the personality. But as a general rule, the undeveloped ego is also undeveloped in his power of impressing himself, page 219, upon his lower vehicles, and perhaps this is just as well. Sometimes, however, as said, an ego, who lacks development in tolerance and wide knowledge, may yet have a will sufficiently strong to impress upon his physical brain orders which show that he is a very young ego, and does not understand. Hence, when conscience seems to dictate something which is clearly against the great laws of mercy and truth and justice, as, possibly, was the case with some of the inquisitors, the man should think carefully whether the universal rule is not a greater thing than the particular application which seems to conflict with it. The intellect should always be used in such a way that it will be an instrument of the ego, page 145, not an obstacle in the path of his development. A curious example of the way in which an ego may manifest himself to the personality is that described in the Mental Body, p. 280. A certain orator, whilst speaking one sentence of a lecture, habitually sees the next sentence actually materialize in the air before her, in three different forms, from which she consciously selects that one which she thinks the best. This is evidently the work of the ego, though it is a little difficult to see why he takes the method of communication, instead of himself selecting the form he thinks best, and impressing that form alone on the personal consciousness. That which is known to mystics as the voice of the silence differs for people at different stages. The voice of the silence for anyone is that which comes from the part of him which is higher than his consciousness can reach, and, naturally, the changes as his evolution progresses. For those now working with the personality, the voice of the ego is the voice of the silence, but when one has dominated the personality entirely, and has made it one with the ego, so that the ego may work perfectly through it, it is the voice of Ma, the triple spirit on the nirvanic plane. When this is, page 220 reached, there will still be a voice of the silence out of the monad. When the man identifies the ego and the monad, and attains adeptship, he will still find a voice of the silence coming down to him from above, but then it will be the voice, perhaps, of one of the ministers of the deity, one of the planetary logoi. Perhaps for him in turn it will be the voice of the solar logos himself. The voice of the silence, therefore, from whatever level it may come, is always essentially divine. The ego works in the physical body through the two great divisions of the nervous system, the sympathetic and the cerebrospinal. The sympathetic system is connected mostly with the astral body, the cerebrospinal system with the mental body, this system coming more and more under the influence of the ego as he advances in intellectual power. As the cerebrospinal system developed, the ego passed on to the sympathetic system more and more of the parts of his consciousness, definitely established, towards which he no longer needed to turn his attention, in order to keep them in working order. It is possible, by the methods of the yoga, for example, for the ego to re-establish direct control over portions of the sympathetic system. To do so, however, is obviously not a step forward, but a step backward, in evolution. The student should recollect that the ego is always striving upwards, trying to get rid of the lower planes, endeavoring to throw off the burdens which prevent his climbing. He does not want to be troubled, for example, with looking after the vital functions of the body, and gives his attention to the machinery only when anything goes wrong. As previously said, all such workings are recoverable, but it is not worthwhile to do so. On the contrary, the more we can hand over to that automatism, the better, for the less we have to utilize the waking consciousness, for the things that are constantly recurring, the more shall we have to work for the things that really need attention, page 221, and that are probably vastly more important, at any rate from the point of view of the ego. Occasionally a man may become dominated by a fixed idea, this resulting in some cases in madness, page 146, in other cases, in the unshakable devotion or determination of the saint or the martyr. These two classes of cases have diverse psychological origins, which we may now study. A fixed idea that is madness is an idea which the ego has handed over to the sympathetic system, so that it has become part of the subconscious.